What's going on? It is Adam. Welcome back to Bringing It Backwards, a podcast where both legendary and rising artists tell their own personal stories of how they achieve stardom. On this episode, we hung out with Keith of We Are Scientists over Zoom video. Keith was born and raised in Miami, Florida, and talks about how he got into music. Was never in a band until college, but he learned how to play guitar while in high school and attended a lot of different local shows. He actually talks about seeing Marilyn Manson before Marilyn Manson got huge. He went to college for 2 years at the University of Florida and then moved to Los Angeles. When he got to Los Angeles, that is when he joined his first band and eventually started a band, met a couple of the guys in We Are Scientists. They moved to Berkeley, California, and that's where the band really started. Keith talked to us about writing his first songs, the success of their first album, getting signed to a major label, the success of the band in Europe, and all about their new record, Lobes, as well as the previous album, Huffy, where all the songs were kind of written and recorded around the same time period. He talks about how he thinks an album should only have 10 songs. They had 14. So that was kind of the building block of what became this most recent record, Lobes. You can watch our interview with Keith on our Facebook page and YouTube channel at Bringing It Backwards. It would be amazing if you subscribe to our channel, like us on Facebook, follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok at Bringing Back Pod. And if you're listening to this on Spotify, Apple Music, Google Podcasts, it'd be incredible if you follow us there as well and hook us up with a 5-star review.
We'd appreciate your support if you follow and subscribe to our podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
We're bringing it backwards with We Are Scientists.
Hey, what's up, Keith? How are you, man?
I'm all right. How you doing?
I'm doing well. I appreciate you doing this.
Ah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Cool. Just you today? Or is Chris coming?
Yeah.
Oh, cool. Perfect. I just didn't know if we had to wait.
Gotcha. Yeah, no, just me.
Awesome, man. Well, I'm Adam, and this is a podcast about you and your journey in music, and we'll talk about the new album.
Cool. Sounds good.
Killer, man. It was crazy. So I come from radio. I did radio for a long time before starting this podcast, but one of the first jobs I had was a company in San Diego, and you guys played like in the studio. It's like, I just found on YouTube, it was 14 years ago.
Oh man.
Yeah, you did. I want to see if I can find it. Yeah. You played, Impatience, After Hours, and Lethal. Oh. So this is like 08, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. We were definitely promoting the second album in that case.
Yeah.
Well, I'll be honest. I don't remember.
It's all good, man. Yeah. So, but yeah, it was just wild. I'm like, oh my gosh, like, I wonder how long ago this was. I was able to
That's crazy.
Dig it up on YouTube. Yeah. 14 years.
Oh my God.
but cool, man. So first off, are you from Berkeley originally? Is that what I read?
No. So, Chris and I went to school in like just sort of outside of Los Angeles, kind of like the very easternmost LA county.
Okay.
And when we graduated, we moved up to Berkeley, and that's where the band started.
Okay.
But neither of us is from California.
Okay, so you're not even from LA. You went to college in LA, and then okay.
Literally arbitrarily. So I grew up in Miami.
Interesting.
And Chris is from Utah, from Ogden, Utah.
Okay, so yeah. Tell me about Miami. What was it like growing up there?
I mean, Miami, it was a weird town. I mean, it's a lot cooler now than it was when I was growing up there. I mean, I guess to be fair, I grew up there in the height of like Miami Vice celebrated sure. Miami. Like, I think Miami had a cool national presence at that point, and I definitely mm-hmm. felt like Miami was like culturally culturally is the wrong word. In the national imagination, it held a culturally cool place, but for music especially, it was a terrible, terrible place to grow up. It's so, you know, even in our experience as a band, it's so far off of any convenient tour circuit that it essentially makes zero sense to visit there on a, you know, regularly routed tour. I think the only times we've ever played South Florida has been like festivals. Like there may have been one show on a tour that we did on our own, but I maybe once.
Really? So yeah, that does make sense, because you wouldn't want to go all the way south because you can't really cut across the, you know, the lower half of the United States. You're way down there.
Yeah, everything is so far apart. And yeah, it's, you know, it's a really one way trip. Like it's not, it's a long drive to get there, and then you have to make that same drive to come back. Maybe you can stop in Orlando or Gainesville, but like, I don't know, man. Just usually we hit Atlanta and make a right, and there's no Florida in it at all.
Okay. But
yeah. So yeah, I kind of grew up never really seeing any like cool national bands. I remember like the Lemonheads came down and that was cool, and the Pixies. But like, oh, I saw White Zombie. It was like that kind of vibe.
That's rad.
But so
but like, even the Pixies, I mean, still.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there. It happened occasionally, but yeah, I kind of grew up really listening to like local bands. Like okay. Local bands were kind of the bands that I thought were really big and important, and then I left, and it turned out nobody had ever heard of them, and in fact, they were pretty bad. Kind of the only band that I was really into, and now it's fairly unfortunate. I was really into Marilyn Manson, who were from Fort Lauderdale.
I was going to say, yeah, he's from Florida, yeah. Right? Yeah.
Yeah. So that was like that was a cool experience in seeing like a band go from playing to, you know, 50 people to being gigantic, you know, national concern. Of course, then I did turn into one of those jerks who was like, I like the demos better, you know.
Oh, so you knew about Marilyn Manson before he blew up.
Yeah, I mean, I went to see them as just like a local band.
That's wild.
Yeah, my wife and I had known each other in New York for like 10 years through mutual friends, but had never really hung out with one another. And one day we were at brunch with, like, you know, we had both been invited by the independent friends. Uh-huh. And I learned kind of for the first time in vaguely knowing her for 10 years that she grew up about 15 minutes from me. And we started talking because she was like, oh, did you used to go see Marilyn Manson at the Plus Five Lounge, which was like this miserable, maybe 150 cap venue that was like a dive bar pool hall that had a stage. And I was like, oh man, I used to go to those all the time. And so we started talking, and only later did I learn that the reason she was going to those shows was because she was friends with this other local band that would play those shows that I absolutely hated. I felt very betrayed, but at that point I liked her too much to break up simply because she was friends with Things of Not.
Okay. And friends with the band that you're like, these guys aren't good.
Well, I begrudged them because they were always playing with Marilyn Manson and they were like our age.
Sure.
Like, oh man. Whereas Marilyn Manson were like old guys. They were probably 22 at the time. So I was like, sure. Oh, these guys are legit. These are adults.
Right. Wow. I mean, I don't want to stay on this too long because I'm just curious. Like seeing Marilyn Manson, I'm not that, never mind. That was the wrong thing to say. But like, I was just going to say, like, seeing Marilyn Manson, that, yeah, was he doing what he, you know, obviously probably not to the extent, but was he like the appearance?
There was a lot of pageantry. It was a little like, it was a little sillier rather than like as harsh as he sort of became. Okay. Once they became a national band, like the aesthetic was very like Scooby-Doo and like Dr. Seuss and like Willy Wonka kind of vibes, like creepy but cartoonish.
Okay.
And like John Waters kind of stuff where it's like deviant but fun deviance, you know.
Yeah, it wasn't what it is
that
now,
was way more
obviously.
The vibe.
Okay.
Yeah. And they were like a little more like they kind of sounded like first album Nine Inch Nails a little more.
Okay.
Or like what the hell is Steve Albini's not Shellac band? Big Bad. What the hell is that? The more like program beats band. Anyway, whatever.
Okay.
They were definitely like a much more like quirky concern.
That's so fascinating to think about that.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. So,
but it was like a big education to watch that band go from, you know, legitimately playing to 40 or 50 people in dive bars to like seeing them open for Nine Inch Nails at Miami Arena and being like, this doesn't make sense.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. Well, did you play in local bands or just part of the scene?
Not at all. Yeah. I played guitar and like I would get together with friends and essentially like, you know, be like, what Pearl Jam song do we all know that we could play? You know, we always play it like we definitely always played Bomb Track by
Rage Against the Machine.
Rage. That was always a big one.
Damn,
that
that's
everybody
a
kind
one.
Of knew. Well, it sounds harder than it is. You know, it's okay. All pretty like, you know, once you get the rudiments of it, it's you're kind of doing the same thing over and over. Okay. But yeah, those were like the limits of me playing music back then. I kind of it took me a long time to cross that threshold of like thinking about writing songs. Like for some reason, I just never. It took a very long time for me to say, oh, you know what? I will also write songs. Like I always just thought of playing music as like, I'll learn this song on the radio that I like, and it's fun to play guitar. Uh-huh. And that was like sort of enough for me for a while. And then, it wasn't until I was in college and I joined. Well, I'd gone to college for 2 years in Florida. And I was like, you know what? I need to get out of Florida. I've been in Florida too long. Okay. Florida is not a place for someone to like only ever live. So I transferred to this school outside of LA and didn't know anybody. And, you know, it seemed like playing music was a pretty quick way to ingratiate myself with people who are vaguely like-minded. Mm-hmm. But the school I went to was definitely kind of like a pretty like hippie leaning liberal arts college. So I ended up very quickly having to join this like kind of jazzy funk band that was really like the only on campus band. But I was really good friends with all the guys in the band. So I was like, you know what? It's not really what I was into, but I need friends. And I need to make friends fast. Michael, the original drummer of We Are Scientists, was in that band. And I ended up pretty much stealing him and the guitar player and starting a like kind of rock band with those guys. And so then we were like, well, I guess we need to write some songs. Like it's kind of easy to be a funk band and play covers at campus events, but to like be at a campus party and do, you know, covers of like lit songs is not cool. That's not, okay. it's not a great look.
Real quick. I'm just curious. So you said you play guitar when you're in Florida. Was that like the first instrument you learned and did you come from a musical household at all? Or this is just, you're the only one in the family doing this.
Yeah. My dad like owned an acoustic guitar. He was, you know, he had definitely bought a guitar in the 70s and was like, I'm going to learn some Crosby, Stills, and Nash songs. Okay. And then never really like advanced enough to learn Crosby, Stills, and Nash songs. So he kind of like had a guitar around that he knew some chords on.
Okay.
And I started playing guitar mainly because my sister, who was older, was very into like hair metal in the late 80s, early 90s, and like loved Bon Jovi and Poison. And so I think maybe for like her 16th, maybe her 15th or 16th birthday, so I would have been 11 or 12, my parents bought her a guitar, like a hot pink Kramer. which was like a, you know, essentially like a glam metal guitar.
Yeah, guitar, sure.
Like very, very 80s. And she took some lessons for maybe a year and then kind of gave it up. And my parents were like, well, somebody's going to play this stupid thing that we bought. So you're next. And I was like, oh, okay, I'll play guitar. Yeah. They had tried to give us like piano lessons when we were little and we just utterly lacked that discipline. Okay. But yeah, for some reason, like essentially self-teaching myself guitar was much more fun than taking regimented piano lessons. Like I did take some guitar lessons, but they mainly were me hanging out with an older dude who played guitar and would just talk to me about guitars. Like I didn't really learn anything in any of my lessons. And I never practiced like theory at all.
Okay. Or like
I had one teacher who was very like, I had a friend who was a really good guitar player and he was like, oh, you should use my teacher. He's really like, he's the reason I'm this shreddy. And I was like, sounds great. In the very first lesson, he was like, all right, yeah. Today we're going to work on some modes. And I was like, I'm out. I want nothing to do with this. All I want to do is play Alice in Chains songs.
Sure, sure. Well, okay. So when you were in school in Florida, you said you wanted to get out of Florida. What makes you decide to leave and go all the way across the whole United States and then land in LA?
Well, I mean, it was sort of twofold. Like I was going to UF for 2 years. And it just like was really not my vibe. It was, it's a giant school.
Mm-hmm. I was a really big nerd.
It's in Gainesville, yeah. And Gainesville is a really fun town.
Yeah, I was gonna say there's a big punk scene out of Gainesville too.
It wasn't really flourishing until I left. Like, I don't remember Hot Water Music really being around. I don't really remember who else. The big
Isn't Against
bands
Me
were.
From there? I'm trying to remember.
I don't know. They definitely were not playing when I was there. I mean, I'm talking like 95, 96.
Okay.
So
yeah, that would have probably been like Hot Water, maybe a right starting around that era.
Yeah. I think they may have existed, but they were not like big enough that they were on my radar.
Gotcha.
But yeah, I mean, UF was like, it's rightly a very sports focused school. Sure. I think the Gators won like the national championship or whatever you call the football thing win in college. Uh-huh. I think they won that year and stuff. So I was just like, this isn't really, I was really into academics. Mm-hmm. And I was just kind of like, seems like people are going to school here just to like get a degree and go to work. And or go to football games,
which is
totally cool. And partying. I wasn't like a partier at that point. Mm-hmm. And so I was just like, I would like to go to a smaller school that is more like academic and art focused. So I ended up going to this liberal arts college called Pomona College.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I was gonna say I'm from San Diego, so I know the area, but like, that's cool. Oh, so you went to Pomona?
Yeah.
Was it Cal Poly Pomona or no?
No. So it's like the Claremont colleges. Okay. So it's like Pomona, Scripps, Claremont McKenna, Harvey Mudd.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
There's one other. Oh, Pitzer.
Okay.
So it's just like a really small, they definitely kind of like model it after an East Coast kind of like wanting to be Ivy League vibes.
Gotcha.
Where like it's just about school.
Okay.
And like, pretty much everybody lives on campus and it was just like an utterly different vibe.
Uh-huh.
But that was kind of what I was into at that point. And
did you, it doesn't sound like you moved there to play music. Did you?
No.
Like, were you trying to pursue something different?
Yeah. So I was like a media studies dude. So it also made sense to go to California.
Sure.
And my initial plan was like to work in film. And so I was like three times a week. I was doing like internships in Hollywood and stuff. Okay. So yeah, that was what my plan was before the band happened.
Okay. Yeah. So you started playing and like you ended up starting like you said a rock band while going there.
Yeah.
And did you get kind of like to then move to Berkeley? Did you like what took you then from that rock band to moving to Northern California?
So the band was definitely a very casual enterprise. Like we would play at events on campus that our friends arranged. That was
okay.
That was like pretty much the extent of what we did. It was definitely a hobby, not a thing we were actively pursuing. And so sort of, you know, in we graduated in 99, and at that point, you know, the dot-com boom was occurring in San Francisco. So pretty much everybody at our school immediately moved to the Bay Area to get jobs in like online enterprises.
Sure.
So we all just moved to San Francisco because that was like, hey, literally every single one of our friends is moving there. And that's where like new jobs are.
Right.
So yeah, we moved up there. Michael, the drummer of We Are Scientists, was actually a year behind us. So he remained in LA.
Okay.
But Chris Kane, who did not play any instruments at the time, was we had just become best friends, and we actually like bonded more over like comedy and films and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So he and I and a third friend, Scott, all moved in together in Berkeley, and you know, all got, you know, regular day jobs, and were kind of experiencing that post graduation malaise where you're like, oh man, the real world is not as much fun as like sitting around dorm rooms talking about, you know, Noah Baumbach and Peter Jackson films. So we're like, well, what can we do that would be fun? And I had bought a drum kit, and I sort of like lived in the basement of this house we had rented. So I turned it essentially into like a music room, even though I was down there by myself playing music. Scott played a little guitar. And so we're like, well, Chris, I own a bass. Why don't you play bass? And we'll start a band. And so we essentially started We Are Scientists as a joke project, where all of the songs were tied into essentially like a universe, an intellectual property universe that was a trio of scientists fighting monsters. So all of our songs initially were songs about different fights we got into.
Wow, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, there's no reason for you to realize that, because we definitely did not want to release any of those songs once we started writing real songs. But that was really how we kind of got into like actively writing songs, because writing kind of like we wrote joke songs, but the music was actually pretty cool. Like I still like they were very like Green Day indebted. They were very like pop punk, a lot of harmonies, like super fast, played very sloppily, and then like very slowly the lyrics morphed into like real song lyrics. Like they started out being pointedly joke songs about fighting monsters. Okay. Then they kind of turned into like slightly like still pretty jokey, but more vague metaphysical science worries. Mm-hmm. And then just morphed into just, you know, songs about, you know, romance or whatever.
Was it like a slow kind of transformation, or like one day were you like, oh, actually I have this song that doesn't, you know, really fit the jokey narrative that we've been doing?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I on the side wrote a lot of non-jokey songs, but they were very like emo vibes. Okay. So we're very like, you know, first album Death Cab for Cutie kind of okay. stuff. And I definitely wasn't interested in doing that. Like that just kind of what didn't seem like a fun project. I liked writing the songs, but the idea of like going out and playing those kind of made me break into a cold sweat. I like playing punk songs.
Yeah.
I think eventually those just kind of like merged, and I kept the musical base of We Are Scientists and just started taking the lyrics from the other songs and sticking them in fun pop songs.
Okay. Was there like, were you playing around Berkeley? Like as We Are Scientists, like were you doing shows like Gilman or any like the Oakland or San Francisco area?
So we never did a show at Gilman. I think we weren't quite punk enough for Gilman.
Okay.
We lived like two blocks from Gilman. So we went to Gilman a bunch. We played at a few like kind of dive bar venues. We played a place in Oakland called the Port Light, which I think might not be there anymore.
I lived up there in like 2009 or maybe 2010 to like 2014-ish. I don't remember that place.
Yeah. It was kind of like Jack London Square.
Oh, zone. Sure. Okay.
But yeah, I'm sure it's probably gone. I mean, it was a sort of place that like once gentrification else. Hits, it's yeah. the sort of place that gets demolished for condos immediately.
Okay. Okay. I didn't know if they flipped into some like hip coffee shop or something like that. Maybe.
Yeah, they may that may well be what happened.
Okay. And then what's kind of like the next moment for the band? Like, did you guys do something or did somebody kind of discover what you were doing? Like, how do you continue doing that and steer away from, I don't know, maybe the 9-to-5 jobs that you have?
Yeah. Well, so in 2001, I think, you know, Chris and I had like both broken up with girlfriends that we'd had, and we were kind of like, our jobs were like good jobs, but not things we actually wanted to be actively doing. Mm-hmm. So we're like, you know what, let's get out of San Francisco and let's move to New York. My grandfather had a house in Brooklyn that he no longer like lived in, and it was just essentially sitting empty, and I was like, we can go live there, we'll like, you know, pay the property taxes on the house and essentially live there for almost free,
right?
So we moved out to New York, and it was essentially a coincidence that we moved to New York just as Brooklyn was becoming like the music capital of the world. So we kind of got there and like, you know, the Strokes were just starting to like blow up. Like, Is This It hadn't come out yet. Mm-hmm. And so like, Yeah, yeahs were happening. I think the first band I ever saw in New York was Interpol playing at like Bowery Ballroom or something like that, which is a 500 cap.
That's wild.
So there was just like immediately, and especially coming from San Francisco, which at that point was suddenly very like arts unfriendly because of how expensive it had gotten so quickly. Mm-hmm. New York suddenly felt like, you know, especially Williamsburg, just like nothing but people making art and like living there only to pursue their creative pursuits.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody was also really very, very good at it. So it was simultaneously like incredibly inspiring and humiliating. Like, we were just like, oh, we're a terrible band. Like, there's no way to compete with these other bands at the level we're currently operating at. We need to get good fast. So it really kicked our asses, and we got a lot better very, very quickly.
Okay.
Out of pure necessity.
Necessity of doing. Yeah. That. Okay. And then so at that point, how long after that do you put out like the first record or maybe the like an EP or something? Like,
so we made we made a record with some friends of ours, you know, who just lived like in a loft in Bushwick and had, you know, an 8-input Pro Tools rig, you know, in their kitchen. So we sort of made that, and it was, you know, terrible. And like didn't do anything. You know, we essentially pressed it ourselves just mm-hmm. as a marketing item. And I think we started getting a little bit of a name for ourselves when we kind of fell in with this group of like Yale theater grads who had all like just recently left theater school up in Connecticut. And, you know, I guess being from Yale seemed like maybe they had some family money to play with.
Okay.
And they essentially got this space in Times Square that they made into like a essentially like a black box theater gallery kind of. And mm-hmm. they would just like put on art shows and have like people show films there and stuff like that. So I don't even really remember how we met them. Maybe mutual friends had a show at the space. It was called the Box.
Okay.
And we just went, and we, you know, I think because we were kind of like, you know, nerdy, kind of like art focused dudes, quickly like got along with these kids that were running this space. And they were just like, why don't you put on like a monthly show and just like invite people to come do stuff. So that gave us like a little bit of a foot in the door to hang out with like bands we didn't know. Like it sort of let us like cold call some bands that were probably cooler than would have played in like the bars that were booking us elsewhere in town. Like, mm-hmm. you know, at that point we were just playing like the bars in town that like have music every night, but it's not a real venue. You know what I mean?
Like, right, it's not like a regular show that people are.
Yeah, exactly. Like no bands that were on national tours would play there. It was really for like local bands that weren't yet on the radar of like the bigger promoters in town. So anyway, okay. this space like gave us these recurring series of shows, and we got some like cool bands to, you know, cool small local bands, but bands that would play at like, you know, First Night at Bowery Ballroom or whatever, mm-hmm. to come and like play these shows. And we got like Eugene, we were really into the comedy scene in New York mm-hmm. at the time. And so we got like Eugene Merman to come do a stand-up set. We got Tim and Eric before they had Tom Goes to the Mayor. Tim and Eric came and did a thing there and stuff. So it was just kind of like a cool way to like get ourselves into the scene without relying on other people, without uh-huh. without needing a promoter to say, you know, I'm gonna stake these guys and put them on a show. So those ended up like going really well, and by the end of, I don't know, we probably did like 8 of those. And by the end of it, we had 200-300 people at those shows. And so, you know, then managers just started talking to us, and promoters started putting us on at like smaller rooms. And it just kind of like went snowballed from there. Yeah.
Cause when you put your first record out, or the debut album, you uh-huh. were on you got signed to a major label, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So that started, because a friend of ours from Pomona College had like a childhood friend who was our age, or maybe even a little younger, who had a job in like the college radio department at Hollywood Records, which was like owned by Disney, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah. And
I think he was like, well, I don't really want to, you know, work in, you know, a tiny department at a big label that's like putting out music I don't care about. So I want to start being a manager. So will you let me manage you and, you know, see what happens. There are no strings attached. Just like, you don't have a manager. I want to be a manager. Can I be your manager? Okay. We're like, yeah, sure. And so because he worked at, you know, this major label subsidiary, he had a lot of contacts, and he eventually, to his great credit, got us a publishing deal with Sony ATV.
Mm-hmm.
And it, the advance was essentially like just enough to make a record, in a pretty Spartan way, but humorously, part of the conditions of our contract with them were that to like fulfill the terms of the deal, we had to sign to a major label. Like the album we made with the, you know, pretty small advance they gave us, then had to, I guess, at least get us a deal with a major.
Okay.
So we were like, well, I guess that's what we're going to be now, because we don't have the money to make a record, and we want it. This will be like the best case scenario, that we will make a record that we want to make. You know, the big fear you sort of always have with a major label is they kind of like oversee everything and kind of hem you in, and then also shelve your record.
Right, like, exactly. Well, yeah. So at least at this point, you'd have the record, and they're just going to buy and like, it from we're making,
yeah, we'd make this record, and it would be the record we wanted to make. So we had done some demos with this dude, Ariel Rechtscheid, who was our manager's roommate at the time, and is now one of like the biggest producers in LA. But at the time had not produced anything of note. We recorded, you know, again, recorded like in their kitchen. I think we did the drums of these demos that we had done, did the drums in like maybe a studio for a day, and then recorded the rest at his house. And we're just like, Ariel's really cool. He's cooler than we are, or like he's like hipper than we are, but he gets us. He like knows the stuff we're into and what, how we're not nailing it and how to make us nail it. So we're like, we really want to make this record with Ariel. Uh-huh. And so we ended up like going to LA for 3 weeks and making what became our first record in like a terrible, terrible studio in the Valley, where like multiple days we had to take off because their computer would just crash. And they'd be like, we need to get a guy to come in and fix the computer.
Oh man.
But yeah, you know, I think that's like part of what makes us like that record versus a lot of other major label debuts we've heard, is that like kind of has a lot of character. Like, it doesn't feel very like super polished. Like the songs are very, very poppy, but the performances are kind of like scrappy.
Mm-hmm.
And then, yeah, we got a booking agent. I feel like we were like one of the last bands that I've ever heard of that actually used South by Southwest to get signed. We played a showcase at South by Southwest. And I think I'd like just been talking to some major labels at that point. But after South by Southwest, we just had like a bunch of offers, and we were like, oh, okay, well, I guess I'm quitting my job, because it looks like this is what we're doing. It looks like this is what we're doing now.
Well, that must have been a huge moment, though, to be able to go into your job or quit your job and say, you know, my band's doing this, and we're, you know, this is going to be my life.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. I think maybe especially for me. Well, I think Michael had a good job. But probably it was a very boring job. It was like he was doing like IT at a bank. So I think probably quitting his job was the scariest financially.
Okay.
My job, I think, was like the scariest emotionally to quit. So I was working at IFC Films.
Oh, wow.
And we were like making cool movies. And it was kind of like the career track that I had actually had in mind.
Right. Yeah. It sounds like you wanted it to film. And then that's a cool spot to be too.
It was cool, but it felt like, you know, I was pretty clear eyed about how realistic a job in music was, which is to say not very realistic at all. maybe especially by virtue of having like signed to Virgin Records, where like if it didn't go well, they would absolutely just drop us, you know. I distinctly remember like when we were going to South by Southwest, the meat of my job there was like reading all of the scripts that came in. Like I was kind of the first gatekeeper for reading scripts. So I just read every terrible script that came in. So like every week I was reading like 20 scripts and maybe one of them would be like decent to good. And then I would send that to my boss and be like, this is one out of this pile of garbage that you should read.
Okay.
So I distinctly remember like sitting in the van going to South by Southwest, like being in the back of the van with just this pile of scripts next to me, like working remotely, like emailing my coverage of the scripts in on the way to South by Southwest. And then after South by Southwest, we drove to LA to also do some showcases. But at that point, we kind of knew that we were going to sign with EMI.
Uh-huh.
So I was kind of like, this trip to LA is kind of stupid. And I'm sitting here with a big pile of scripts next to me that now kind of feels utterly superfluous.
Yeah.
Should I just fly home? Do I need to be doing any of this right now? definitely quitting that job was vaguely haunting experience. I remember being like, I can't believe I'm about to say this, but this is my 2 weeks notice. Gotta go.
Yeah.
And I remember they were actually pissed because I was supposed to be going to the New York Film Festival. Like I was supposed to be doing a lot of the screenings at the New York Film Festival to see if we wanted to acquire anything. And I was like, so remember when I was supposed to go to all these movies at the New York Film Festival? I'm going to be in England, so I'm not doing that. Bye. I gotta go. Sorry. I know you're mad at me.
They were
pretty pissed. I bet.
They survived though.
They didn't. Probably because I left.
Oh, are they gone now?
I think IFC Films is no longer. IFC the channel still exists, but I think their film. Maybe they're still around.
Yeah, you took them down.
I mean, they lasted for a while. It didn't end with my 2 weeks notice.
2 weeks later, they collapsed.
They just started packing up. They spent those 2 weeks putting stuff into boxes.
Oh, well, that's incredible. To have that opportunity and then to, you know, kind of land that deal and everything. You know, like I said, I saw you guys in 2008-ish, so you would have had your second record, I think, had came out, or you're promoting it.
Yeah.
And that another record that did really well. I mean, to have after, you know, the debut that you got to kind of record yourself and then present to the label, and then putting one out with a label, was that, you know, they talk about the second album being, you know, the one, like, is this going to work out kind of deal? Like,
right.
Were you guys did you have that mindset going into it, or is it just like, whatever, let's just keep writing the songs that we do?
I probably half and half.
Okay.
You know, like, I think we definitely approached the songwriting the same way, but we definitely also knew that we were in a very good but precarious position. Especially because we ended up doing much, much better in Europe than in the US. Like our album went gold in the UK. Mm-hmm. And like And we were in a, we were also in a weird position because we were signed to Virgin US, but we spent all of our time in the UK. Like the promotional rollout for that second record was all done in the UK. Chris and I moved to London for 3 months leading up to the release of that album and spent that whole time promoting it there. So it was Virgin was like in constant, incredible turmoil the entire time. Mm-hmm. I think over the course of our being there, over two albums, they had three different presidents in the US. In the UK, they switched presidents at least once. They got bought by a German company that, or I think they were a Dutch company whose last great success was buying all the bathrooms on the German Autobahn and making them really good and profitable.
Interesting. So
it was just like we like having this infrastructure behind us, but we are not, we in no way feel that we are that we want our fortunes to be utterly tied to this corporation.
Gotcha. Yeah.
And in fact, so we after our second record, we asked to move our contract to Virgin UK, like just to have them run it entirely. Because like the way our contract worked out, like Virgin US would make all the money because they owned the contract.
The contract, yeah.
Virgin UK would get all the credit for it, but they weren't, we were not their cash cow.
Right.
And so we're like, you know, it would make more sense if the people that were putting up all of like the effort and stakes essentially were also getting the rewards. So we started talking about moving our contract. And as that happened, they got a new president and many of the people we worked with, you know, left EMI, probably were just fired.
Yeah.
And we were like, you know what? Maybe we don't want to move our contract here. Sure. And so we essentially like used that contract switch as a way of getting out of our, I think we had like a 5-album deal with EMI.
Oh,
but
wow.
because we were starting this new contract, we essentially were able to say,
yeah,
maybe we don't want to sign this contract. Unfortunately, you don't want to sign a contract with us because we need a much better contract than that. Like we essentially like negotiated ourselves out of the contract.
Okay.
Very thankfully.
Yeah.
Because Virgin essentially just stopped being a label shortly thereafter. And then EMI got bought by Universal and like, who the hell knows what's going right, on over there.
Exactly. Wow. To jump ahead a bit here, because I love the new album. I want to talk to you about the album. And the first song, Operator Air, that was written during the time of Huffy, right? Was it? Okay, so that was just a song that was maybe going to go on that record, and then you held on to it? Like, how did that work out?
Yeah, we had a real bumper crop of songs for the Huffy recordings. So we kind of like went into that knowing we have this vaguely arbitrary theory. And when I say we, I mean me, that albums should only be 10 songs.
Okay.
Anytime I'm listening to an album that's over 10 songs, I'm always like, man, you guys should have called me. I can tell you what songs to cut from this record.
Should have cut two of these.
So I'm kind of always just like, you know what? We can release other songs outside of albums, but especially now in like the era of streaming, I just feel like if there's so much information flying around all the time anyway, let's try to like focus people's attention on the songs that we really want them to focus on. And if we want to release other songs other times, then they will get focused on. Like, I kind of feel like now more than ever, the songs that aren't spotlit on an album kind of like are utterly forgotten about.
Yeah, unfortunately.
So we're kind of like, well, we could make, you know, a 16 song album that we thought every song was great on, but we don't want to do that because then six of these songs that we think are great are going to be like buried at the bottom of our streaming numbers. Sure. So we kind of were like, well, a bunch of these songs are also different enough that we could like reasonably separate them and kind of approach these two albums separately. So I think at that point we actually had 14 songs that we loved, 10 of which were kind of more rock guitar songs and 4 of which were like more synth based and like electronic drums, kind of like just like dance pop kind of vibes. And then quarantine happened and we had just started recording Huffy at that point and we had the studio space. So I was just going into the studio by myself and I wrote a few more songs that definitely fit much more in the Lobes vibe. Okay. So we're like, okay, well, we definitely now have two albums. Let's set these songs aside, finish Huffy, and then finish Lobes. But yeah, Operator Error was like, I think Operator Error was maybe the one song that we were like, this song could kind of go either way. Like we could choose to make this a Huffy song or a Lobes song. And it kind of feels like the stepping stone between those two albums.
Oh, that's interesting
to me. Yeah.
You guys self-produced the Huffy, didn't you, because of the circumstances of COVID?
Yeah. And I mean, that was the plan all along.
Oh, it was. Okay.
Because it essentially happened because we've been over the years just like started doing all of the demos on our own rather than like going into a studio. We kind of just like produce them ourselves. So after a while we started, you know, on the past couple of albums before Huffy, we're like, at this point we're kind of like chasing the demos we made, or in some cases simply augmenting the demos we made, like using tracks from the demos and just getting better drum sounds or whatever.
Sure.
So kind of like we've gotten a lot better at figuring out what arrangements maximize these songs and like let's just like rent a studio. We rented a space from our friend who's going on tour, who owns a studio. And we're just like, we have like 3 months of studio space because he's out of town. Let's just try to produce it ourselves. If at the end of the 3 months it sucks, we can take the tracks, bring them to a producer and say, help us make these correct. But we ended up loving it.
Yeah, no, it's a killer record. Did you do the same with Lobes, or was that whole batch of songs done the same way?
Yeah, like so all, pretty much
both albums, I mean.
Yeah, well, so unfortunately for our friend who owned the studio, he, despite living in New York, was not a U.S. citizen. Oh. And so his band was on tour once when quarantine was enacted and he was not allowed to come back to his home in New York. So he was trapped in Ireland for like 6 months. I mean, fortunately, when I say trapped in Ireland, his family lives in Ireland. So he was
right. But he just couldn't get back to New York to his spot.
He was essentially living with his mom for 6 months.
Oh, man.
But yeah, he was not allowed to come back to New York. So we very graciously told him we'd look after his studio for him.
That's nice.
And so we did the basic tracking for both of those records in that period. Like all the drums and like a lot of the bass and guitar were done then. And then we spent, you know, maybe like 6 months after that doing all the post-production stuff in this room my house and at Chris's.
That's killer, man. I think the album's awesome. Thanks. I really like it. Human Resources, I think, is my favorite song on the record.
Nice. I think it's maybe mine too.
Really?
It is right now, at least. Yeah.
I think I've listened to it through a few times, or the album a few times, and I'm like, I just keep going back to that one. God, this is such a good
song. Yeah, I think like it became a favorite of mine because it wasn't a single. And so like now I have extra affection for it on top of just like liking it. I'm like, you're like a nice little, you're like the best underdog.
Yeah, no, it's a great, I mean, I love the singles that you put out too in the whole album, but that one always just, I just kept coming back to, I was like, God, that song's so good. So just, that's been my, my favorite from the album. Yeah. And, again, I appreciate your time today, man. Thank you so much, Keith. Like this has been so much fun.
Thank you.
I do have one more quick question before I let you go. I know it's taking up too much of your time, but I want to know if you have any advice for aspiring artists.
I don't know. That is a great question. I mean, I think sort of like to go back to what I was saying about that venue that we kind of had that residency in Times Square is, I think like kind of the best thing you can do is create a scene on your own and like be friends with as many. I mean, yeah. And if I'm being honest, probably doing that online is more important now than doing it in your hometown. Like just interacting with other people who are making music and like kind of forging mutual friendships that kind of like shine light on one another. It's kind of like the best thing you can do. So you're not relying on third parties to like kind of do your promoting for you. I do think like forging alliances with like-minded people is kind of my greatest advice.